Halloween Tuesday, and Halloween is my favorite holiday, so I'll be playing you some Halloween music here and there during the show. It's my great pleasure, even an honor, to have on as my first guest, James Atlas. He is a man of letters, as we like to say, but he is also a child of Evanston. His latest book is The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale. It is a... Jim, how are you, first of all? How is everything? Happy Halloween and all that stuff. Hey, Jim, hi. Sorry, my headphone wasn't plugged in correctly. How are you? Happy Halloween. And this...
Oh, good. Nice to talk to you, Rick. So
you too.
Are we on
We are on live on WGN Radio, going to hundreds of thousands of people. This is a remarkable book. I have been a huge fan of yours, as you know, for almost forever, through your biographies of Delmore Schwartz and Saul Bellow, especially Saul Bellow, because I knew him. This book, The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale, is I'm gonna say it's unique, Jim. I've never really read a book like this. Am I making too much of it? I've never read a book like this.
Well, one can't make too much of it. No, it's my book. One or two books that are somewhat like it, but I don't think I do think it's sui generis. I do think it's unique. Richard Holmes, the British biographer, wrote a wonderful book called Footsteps, in which he follows in the path of four of his subjects, and it's a very impressionistic book that's really about his own coming of age as a biographer. But my book is, I admit, it's strange. There's no question about it.
No, but I must tell you, though, it's for me, it was an incredibly compelling read, in part because it's an autobiography of a biographer's life, the biographer being you. You really came to literature to sort of localize this whole thing. You came to the arts as a child growing up in Evanston, did you not?
Yeah, I really did. And Evanston High School was, at that time when I was there, was the number one high school in America. And I had at least two, perhaps three inspiring teachers, creative writing teachers, who just made literature seem like a kind of romantic fantasy, an incandescent thing, the thing I wanted to be. And I got so much encouragement from these teachers for my little poems. And I also got to know Gwendolyn Brooks, the famous Chicago poet.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And then I worked for Poetry Magazine, and Henry Rago was a mentor. He was the editor then. So I did feel that there was really, it may not have been Paris in the 20s, but it was a world that was very nurturing.
Well, one of the other aspects of your teenage years was your exploration and discovery of, and what I think has played an incredible influence in your life is the blues club that you poor little white kid somehow traipsed down and found on the South Side. That you seem to get a remarkable kind of creative energy from places like, I don't know, Teresa's Lounge, if that's one of the places you visited. How were you drawn to those places and those performers? I mean, it was an unusual thing. I mean, Corky Siegel, the great white blues artist here, had a similar teenage course. He then went on to become a legendary musician. How were you drawn to those places and those artists, and what did they do for you, James Atlas?
And then don't forget my friend, my North Shore suburban friend, Rich Cohn, who...
Sure.
And the Chess Brothers, the founders of one of the original rock and roll labels in Chicago, I published. But for me, my son was stunned when he read an interview with me in the New York Times, and I said I'd been going to these clubs. He said, I didn't know that. That's part of your life. But I ran with the good crowd and the bad crowd.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were the same people, like I was. And we were in many ways academic high performers, but we also hung out in the clubs. We heard about them. And it was amazing to me when you think of all the racial
tensions that later...
that have risen since.
Yeah.
So we're talking 1966 here when I'm 17 years old, and I go to Teresa's, it was a completely natural experience. Mm. And there were other places that I went, also blues clubs. I can't remember, Kingston Mines
sure,
came later.
Sure,
but
later.
You felt that you belonged there, and it was not a big deal.
Right,
and
right.
You could go at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it just, for me, I thought, this is art. This is some. It's not just T.S. Eliot who I'm reading feverishly in my bedroom at home.
Yeah,
but
it's Muddy
I'm
Waters.
Here in this
yeah.
Club.
Well, I think that is what's given you in all the writing I've read of yours a kind of. You're right. You are yes. You are very smart, and you are an academic, and you are an esteemed publisher and writer. But you also have that kind of what I would call a street feel. In a lot of ways, James Atlas, like you know, one of the subjects of your biography, I always had thought Saul Bellow had that street feel too. Am I wrong?
No, Bellow had it in spades. I mean, Bellow had attitude, and that was one of the things that I admired most about him, but also found hardest to deal with. But when I think of my own friends from Chicago, people like Scott Turow,
sure,
even Jacob Weisberg, who went on to found Slate, or Jonathan Alter, the journalist. There's something, or Don Katz, who founded Audible.
Yeah, yeah.
People are very, they have a stubborn Chicago-ness that I really identify with and recognize. And you can hear it even in their accents, their voices. Like, why do they live in the East for 40 years and still have Chicago accents like I do?
I love it. James Atlas's latest book is The Shadow in the Garden, a phrase that came from Saul Bellow, and we'll talk about how he borrowed that phrase for this fantastic, unique book. It's subtitled Biographer's Tale, and it is his tale, how he came to be an esteemed biographer of the sad, sad Delmore Schwartz. We'll tell you more about him. And the strangely, I find, kind of ignored Saul Bellow. I think Saul has sort of, he hasn't quite gone out of favor the way Nelson Algren may have, but he's kind of gone out of favor. We'll explore that more with James Atlas again, The Shadow in the Garden. We'll explore it more after a short commercial break. Again, Halloween's my favorite holiday, so indulge me. It is Tuesday. I'm talking with James Atlas, a child of Evanston and the author of two remarkable biographies, Delmore Schwartz, The Life of an American Poet, and Bellow, a biography. His latest book is The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale, which is sort of like an autobiography. Jim, it's very interesting. We were just talking about your experiences in Evanston High School and on the South Side in blues clubs. I'm not sure I will ever again mention in the same sentence, talk about the influences on one person of both Buddy Guy and Richard Ellman, who... I don't think those two names have ever been mentioned in the same sentence. You were lucky enough to sit and listen to Buddy Guy, and you were also incredibly fortunate because where do you rate Professor Ellman, writer Ellman, as a biographer? His biography of Joyce is, James Joyce, that is generally accepted to be one of the great masterworks of modern literature, is it not?
Yes, I think that's one of the great biographies. Let's not forget, since we're talking about Chicagoland here, that Ellman taught at Northwestern for many years.
That's right, that's right.
He was an Evanstonian, and he grew up in the Midwest also. And when I studied with him at Oxford, he also had the same accent problems. He wrote a classic book that I think is one of the two or three great biographies of modern times. And I happen to have a fellowship, a Rhodes Scholarship, over to England and when he was teaching there. And I persuaded him to be my tutor. So that was really the beginning of my vocation, was seeing that Ellman had written these great books. And it was a very appealing way of life.
Oh, no question. Did you, before diving, and it's detailed in the Shadow in the Garden, it's kind of the portrait of a biographer as a young man. Did you, you couldn't have any notion when you selected the two major subjects, Delmore Schwartz and Saul Bellow. The Bellow book took you way more than a decade, did it not?
Yes, the Bellow book took me 11 years, but you have to, well, not way more, but 11 years. But I had jobs most of the time. I worked at the New York Times as an editor, and I was a staff writer for The Atlantic, and I was a grown-up with children. When I wrote my first book, I just sat home by myself, and no one ever called me from 1 month to the next, and I 3 years because no one was interested in
the freedom. Yes, the freedom of a biographer.
Those are ideal circumstances for writing a biography. So I did it 3 years.
Talk to me about, and not just me, but I know a bit about Delmore Schwartz, a huge bright literary light as a young man. Had one of these sort of, he had a sad life, and could you detail it for listeners who may have forgotten even who this person was?
Yeah, it's amazing to me. First he's forgotten, and then I write my book, and Bellow writes Humboldt's Gift, which is about Delmore, and he's revived, and now he's forgotten. I can't do it anymore. Someone else has to revive him this time. But he was a member of what was then called the Partisan Review crowd of heavyweight intellectuals in New York in the post-war period, and including Bellow became a close friend of his, and the critic Dwight MacDonald. And Delmore, by the time he was 24, had written one of his best stories, In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, and T.S. Eliot himself was writing to Delmore, telling him that he was the great poet of his generation.
Wow.
So by the time he was in his 30s, he was already on the downhill slope, and he was on amphetamines and alcoholic and had lost his way, and he ended after 20 years of this deterioration and misery, dying in a hotel in Midtown Manhattan at the age of 52 of a heart attack.
It's just, I remember, if I remember correctly, and it's only from your work that I would remember this, that he died either after taking out the garbage or thinking about taking out the garbage or something like that. I mean, it struck me as tragic and symbolic on a number of different levels. He's a fascinating guy, and you did. I haven't read the book in about 5 years, but you did a remarkable job with him. Is that what drew you to Bellow? There are a lot of reasons to be drawn to Bellow, who, you know, sort of knew my father, and I knew him only a bit. I found him incredibly smart and irascible in person at the same time. You spent a lot of time with him, didn't you?
I did. What did Herman, your father, think of him?
Well, I'll tell you one quick story that I think you'll be amused. There was some writers event giving awards at the what was used to be the main branch of the Chicago Public Library and had just turned into the Cultural Center. And I remember there were a bunch of local writers there, and Saul and my father were over in a corner talking. They'd known each other for decades. And they were talking, and some writer came up to me and goes, "Look at that. Isn't that unbelievable? Look at your dad and Saul Bellow, two of these great Jewish intellectuals. I gotta just imagine what they're talking about." So I didn't have to imagine. It's my father. So I walk over there. What are they talking about? Saul is saying, "Herman, this tuxedo is really horrible. You got to go see my guy on Roosevelt Road. He'll get you a nice tuxedo for like $40. And I'm thinking, yes, oh, this is a great Jewish intellectual. Herman liked Bellow, but also found him to be irascible and unquestionably a great writer. But in all the time you spent with him, and, you know, the interesting thing, and you bring it out so dramatically, I think, in The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale, is the relationship that has to exist. It has to be one of trust, but also you are a detective of sorts. You're a psychoanalyst of sorts. You're wearing a lot of hats as a biographer, aren't you?
Yeah, I think that part was very hard for him. It was hard for both of us because he enjoyed, and he used that word, that verb, often. He enjoyed talking about his past. He enjoyed driving around the Northwest Side, which had been his Jewish neighborhood when he was growing up. And all of this was very nostalgia-inducing for him. At the same time, he was aware that I was studying him, that I was writing his portrait, and I wanted to know about everything. And I remember he said once to me, sort of doubtfully, "Everything?" Like, yes, everything. But he was someone who fascinated me because of my own family, who came from the same, my father came from that neighborhood, and there were many cross currents there, and a bakery bought and sold by a relative,
sure.
And Bello ogling my mother on the subway, on the elevated train to Northwestern. And I mean, he was a vivid, real presence to me. So I wanted to know about my own life. It was a way of finding out about my own life by studying his.
Jim, you never used a tape recorder for this. Now, you're a note taker, aren't you? In the classic, I think, in the classic style, yes.
Well, in the long distant past, when I would do a profile for the New York Times of Mailer or Updike or one of these great men, I would use a tape recorder. But I went to interview Naipaul once in London, and I turned on my tape recorder, and he kind of smashed the table with his hand and said, "Put that away. It makes you lazy." So I decided he was right. And with Bello, it's true that instead of taping it, I visited with him. I felt like we were talking.
Yeah.
And I admit in the book that I would, as soon as I left the premises,
you would write.
I would write in my notebook.
Yep.
And therefore, I did have a very clear sense of what he was saying without having the tape recorder. And I think it helps, because if you have the tape recorder, it formalizes the experience.
See, I agree. I have never in my, well, I'm not a biographer, but in my many, many stories for the newspapers, I never use a tape recorder. Never. I trust myself to, and I do what you do, I write immediately after whatever the encounter is, and I trust myself to remember accurately what I or my mind thinks is important. This book, The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale, has been terribly well. When you get a jacket quote from Ron Chernow, who is, as Lin-Manuel Miranda told me, the luckiest biographer in the history of biography.
We all feel that way about Ron.
And he knows it. Well, the nice thing is, Lin told me, he said, and he knows it, too. He's got a nice jacket quote here. When do you plan to come back? You plan to come back to visit?
To Chicago?
Yeah.
I definitely do. I missed, because of illness, I missed an event at the bookstall in Winnetka and at the University Club, and I missed my 50th high school reunion, which was all devastating, but I'm hoping to reschedule everything but the reunion.
Let me know, and I'll have you, you can come in studio, and we can do this face-to-face, because I would love to see you, because I absolutely love this book. It's honest, it's markedly self-effacing, but it's a fascinating, as I say, it's a fascinating ride, and unlike any book that you will find on the bookshelf, The Shadow in the Garden, A Biographer's Tale. It is kind of a portrait of one of the great biographers of our time, James Atlas, and that's not just because he grew up in Evanston and went to Teresa's Lounge. Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and congratulations on this thing.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on the show, Rick.
Oh, my
pleasure. I will show up soon.
Yes, let me know when you're in town. Take good care, and happy Halloween, because it's my favorite holiday.
Okay.
Okay, take care.
Thank God.
We will talk to the writer Lori Levy after the news. And then later on at 10, Bradley Parker Sparrow and Joni Pallotta will be in here. And Aubrey Mumpower and I can be amazed at how they have kept their Southport record label up and about and continuing to issue CDs after 40 years. Aubrey, it's the 40th anniversary of Southport Records, which is really pretty amazing. Lori Levy coming up to talk about her first novel, so stay tuned.
Oh, death in the morning. Oh, death in the
Rick Kogan, morning. Upbeat Halloween music. Halloween's my favorite holiday, so I'm treating you to a little of that. It is about time I've been able to have Lori Levy on the air. She'd gotten bumped a couple times because of crazy Blackhawks schedule, but she is on now to talk about her first novel, The Stendhal Summer. Lori, it is so nice to talk to you. How are you?
Oh, I'm just great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. If you have read newspapers or the Tribune magazine or short stories over the last 20 or 30 years, you know the name Lori Levy. She's had a very, very, what I think, prolific. And you were on the show when your short story collection came out. This book, Lori, is a long time in coming, and I find the kind of backstory to it fascinating. Would you mind detailing that before we get into what's between the covers? And I'm going to read a little from it, too, because you know that I've always loved your writing.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you want the story about the story.
Yes. Don't you think it's fascinating? Fascinating, well, frustrating at the same time, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's lengthy, but I'll try to shorten it. This, actually, I've been carrying on about Stendhal since college. And, of course, I would say I'm in love with the Charterhouse of Parma. And everyone would say, who?
What's what? That? Yeah, duh, yeah.
Because nobody in America knows Stendhal very much. And in France, they love him. I mean, he's like Hemingway.
Right, right.
But I just kept going with Stendhal. I kept reading and reading and reading. I read everything he wrote, his diaries, his letters. Then I realized that there were 14 biographies of him, about him in English. Heaven knows how many there are in French.
Yeah.
And I kept reading and reading. And I think at the end I decided that I should be the one to write another biography of Stendhal.
What was it about Stendhal that grabbed you? I mean,
I don't want to.
And Lori, could I, Lori Levy? Could I? I mean, it's almost like an obsession, is it not?
Yes, yeah. It really was. Yeah. I read his letters, I read his diaries, I read his fiction and his nonfiction, and there was just something about it.
Yeah.
The only author I'd ever really adored was F. Scott Fitzgerald,
mm-hmm.
which was typical of my generation.
Sure.
But I don't know why I kept going, and there's something about, there was an affinity between this man, a 19th century writer, and me.
Yeah. Well, but it's a lovely mystery. You don't have to unravel the mystery, too. But you were intent on unraveling and detailing this life, were you not?
Yes. Yeah. And then I decided that I would apply for a grant, which I did get, from the Illinois Arts Council, and I had said to my children, who weren't children by then, they were adults, I said, if I get this grant, I'm going to Europe, to France and Italy for 3 months. Can you do without me? And they said, of course, go follow your dream. So I did. I went to track his life because I was going to write a biography. I wasn't going to write a novel.
Right. Well, you did some. You went and you sort of traced his steps, and then you for some reason, changed your mind and decided
I kept having adventures.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'm going to do a novel about a woman who's doing what I'm doing. Well, I changed a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
But the more I did, the more I thought, this is a comic novel. So I wrote it. In the meantime, I had this big career here, writing and writing and writing.
Well, you had, as I remember, I mean, you were one of the a prolific book reviewer,
yeah.
But you wrote a lot for the Tribune, you wrote for magazine cover stories. You also, if I'm not mistaken, Lori, you had a short story published in the Tribune magazine, did you not?
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
I don't think it's weird at all. I think it's great. But it's unusual. There's no doubt that it's unusual. You had a very, and I know, Lori Levy, that you got job offers, if not from the Tribune, I'm thinking, of course, from the Tribune, and you were determined to remain a freelancer, weren't you?
I had to be freelance. Because I was writing for everybody, I also had a short story in Chicago Magazine, which was really weird because they didn't do fiction.
Yeah, neither, the Tribune didn't do a lot of fiction either, believe me.
It was just a crazy happening. And I was very thrilled because I loved writing fiction, but of course I never worked on the novel. So in the 90s, I was still fooling around with this book, and then I had cancer for a couple of years.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was hard, and so I didn't do any writing. So, and I got a new computer, And one day I tried to find the novel and it was gone.
Oh, God.
Missing.
Ugh.
So I tried everything. I tried to find the hard copy. It was gone. And I don't know, years went by. And one day my son said to me, "You know, I've got your old computer in my basement. Do you still want it?"
And you said,
so
look.
The novel was on that computer.
And how long had it been since you saw that novel? A decade or more?
Yeah, at least.
Oh.
So
were you thrilled or were you thrilled or were you a little trepidatious to read it over again?
Both, because I didn't know.
Yeah, sure.
So I printed the whole book, and then I sat on my bed for about 6 days and read it. And I thought, you idiot, this is a pretty good book.
Yeah.
Why didn't you do something about it?
Yeah.
So while I was thinking about it, and then I started rewriting, you know,
sure.
A writer.
Always, oh, sure.
You just keep reading and writing. And one day somebody said, why don't you send it to this Chicago publisher? I know of. It's a very small publisher. They don't publish very much, but they're very smart people, and they'll tell you if the novel's any good or not.
Hmm.
I thought, well, okay, before I start going to New York and getting an agent and do all that, I'll send it. So I did, and they called me, and they said, we love it. We'd like to publish it.
Oh, my God, you must have been
overwhelmed. I thought, well, this is weird, and why not? You know,
yeah, sure. But the other thing, Lori, in the time span from the time you wrote the novel to today, when it's being published by Amica Press, which is, I've had a number of their authors on, and they are very discriminating. It's a very good house. But the publishing business, I mean, you just said, well, instead of, you know, trying New York, New York is crazy. The publishing business is insane. You know what I mean? It's almost impossible to get an agent. If you, there's a huge kind of blockbuster mentality reigning in this. I think you are incredibly fortunate to have, instead of banged your, it's an eminently publishable book, but it's just so hard to get into those big houses these days.
Right, especially if you're, you know, an unknown.
Right.
Basically.
You know, it's like, hi, I have my first novel. What do you think? It's very hard to get in the door. What was the process like working with those folks? It must have been terrific for you.
It was lovely because they just liked it. They liked the book.
Ugh.
That's funny. I just, it was very easy, and I drifted along with it. And when I told people that I'm finally publishing this novel that I've been fooling around with for, 30 years, 25 years?
Yeah.
Everybody laughed, you know. Well, why not?
Well, no, so, I could not agree with you, why not? I mean, it is basically, it's set in the summer of 90, most of it is set in the summer of 92 when...
Right.
When your protagonist is swimming. Well, we'll talk after that. We got to take a little commercial break, and then we will discuss at length the triumph of Lori Levy getting her first novel published. And I'm going to read a graph or two from it, Lori, because you know I have always been a great admirer of your writing, and I could
nice of you.
Well, it's not nice of me. I can be critical too, and I would have figured out a way to blow you off and not have you on the air. But we've been buddies for a long time, and I've admired your writing for a long time, and I think it's a remarkable thing to get your first novel published after all that time, after it's sitting. You know, and God love your son for keeping an old computer in the basement and say, hey, Mom, I've got your old computer. Maybe there's something good on it. He must give him a hug. We'll be back. We'll be good for you. We'll be back after a short commercial break with the author Lori Levy. And the novel is titled The Stendhal Summer. And she's obsessed with this guy. We'll talk about whether she's still obsessed, having gotten much of this done on paper. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm on the telephone with Lori Levy, one of Chicago's most distinguished authors, who's published... Lori, in your life, you published thousands of articles, haven't you?
Yes.
You haven't ever sat down to count them, have you?
No, never did.
It is my pleasure to have just read a few weeks ago, and then Lori kept getting bumped because of the Hawks games and stuff, but to finally have her on to talk about her sort of rediscovered first novel. I'm going to read, if I may, Lori, one chapter. The protagonist of the book has gone to Europe, where she travels about. She travels to such places as Grenoble, Milan, Rome, Paris, and other places. And in many ways, this woman is happy to be in Europe away from her husband, George, isn't she?
Right.
Yes. George does not seem like a nice person. But she writes she is in Europe when she's lying in bed on a Saturday watching TV in French. And this thought occurs to her. She's writing about that winter. Outside the windows of the apartment she and George so tentatively shared after 30 years of marriage, a bagman dressed in layers rummaged through a deep green Chicago garbage can, thoughtfully placed at the bus stop in Lincoln Park near the bench where he liked to encamp. Since Christmas, she'd left things in that can for him, Pringles and bagel chips and apples. She watched him forage, wishing he knew about her six floors above, longing to call to him and discuss what was on her mind, which was Stendhal. That's just a lovely, lovely paragraph, which says, which I says in just a few lines, a great deal about Alison Miller, who is in search of what she said, following in Stendhal's footsteps, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. She is trying to figure out what to do with her life.
Yeah.
Of course, most novels are set with that type of situation.
Sure. Well, because she's kind of, you can tell people a little about it. She's not terribly pleased with her life here, is
no.
she?
No.
It seems like a kind of, George, you do a great portrait of George. George is like someone I would never, ever want to meet in any walk of life. He's a, he's kind of a semi-big shot in advertising, and he seems like a conceited goof to me. But Alison, on the other hand, just from that one graph that I read, is a giving, loving person who deserves better, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And she's a woman with a dream at that point. And I think one of the things that I have to convince the reader of is that anyone would have a dream so ridiculous. I mean, who is Stendhal? What does it matter?
Right.
Why does she want to go to Europe and track his life? Why does she want to write this unbelievably unnecessary biography? That's what the reader has to buy, you know.
Yeah.
Before they'll believe it.
I certainly do. But, you know, the other thing, Lori Levy, is like, why did Ahab want to find this big white whale, for goodness sake?
Right.
I mean, not everything is so easily explained in life. There are wonderful mysteries in life, and I think, you know, your obsession with Stendhal is one of them. We don't need an answer of why. Something just struck you in a way that has...
Right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
what
true.
What has been, beside me... the reception to the book. I mean, people must, you do have a lot of fans here, dear.
Yeah.
You do.
Well, it's very amazing. People like it.
Yeah.
Which surprises me because I, you know, for years I thought, who's going to buy this book? Who's going to like it?
Well,
but
you've always been, yeah, but you've always been kind of self-effacing. You yourself, has it empowered you as a... As a fiction writer, do you say to yourself, well, I think I have another novel in me?
Yes, I do.
Are you working? Have you been working on it, or are
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I've been. That's another one I've been fooling around with for years. I don't rush into things.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, obviously you don't. Can you tell us anything about that one?
No, it's about a psychoanalyst and a woman who's struggling with her weight.
Okay.
And Years ago,
sure.
I interviewed an analyst who's long been deceased.
Yeah.
And I did a series of articles for him that he was publishing in psychiatric journals about how to handle obesity and so forth.
Oh, how
interesting. And I interviewed him and wrote this for him. Before he died, he published this under his own name. You know, I did this. I wrote for everybody.
Yeah, sure.
So I've got these notes, and I started to write the novel about the analyst, and then I gave him a girlfriend. And,
good.
You know,
well, that's how a novel works. Lori, I cannot congratulate you more profoundly. The Stendhal Summer was a wonderful read, and you were...
thank you, Rick.
It's an adventure. I'm not giving too much away. There's a good love story in this book, too, ladies and gentlemen. A very, very good love story, and a really lousy guy in George, I'll tell you that. Lori, you keep in touch. Let me know about that next book, will you please?
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm glad we finally did this again. My pleasure. The author is Lori Levy, and the novel is her first novel, many decades in coming, called The Stendhal Summer. Lori, happy holidays to you and all that stuff and your family, too.
Same to you, Rick.
Okay,
thank you
take
so
care.
Much.
Thanks. What a lovely woman and a really prolific writer. As I told you before, we hear some jazz at 10 o'clock. Halloween is my favorite holiday because it has never borne the horrible responsibilities of family and guilt and all sorts of other things that I encounter at Thanksgiving and Christmas. And there's a long piece in today, not a long piece, there's a story, and I dressed up for the first time in a couple decades. For this Halloween, I dressed as the ghost of the Daily News and Panorama.
I saw that picture. You look awesome.
Yeah,
I
look like a ghost.
I tried reading the headlines.
It looked like a ghost. Yeah. I know the headline. I look like a ghost.
Yeah.
It was fun. I was in this Arts in the Dark parade last Saturday, but I may wait another 20 years.
No, come on.
I'll go as Roger Battish.
No, that would scare everybody. Adults and children.
Yeah. You don't dress up, do you?
You know what? I have for here.
Yeah.
And I used to when I was teaching.
Right, right.
But it wasn't anything elaborate. I wore like a Star Trek shirt one year.
Yeah.
And I used to dress up during the year anyway for different subjects I was teaching.
Course.
You know,
yeah,
Shakespeare
sure.
one year or something. Sure. But, I love seeing my grandkids dress up. And
it's a kid's holiday.
Yeah.
So that's the reason.
But
I did bring one for
this year. I made it up today, actually. It took me like 10 minutes to make. I'm not going to say what it is.
Don't tell me what it is.
You'll see the pictures.
Come in here.
Yeah.
All right, Roger.
Yeah.
We'll see in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
Here's a Halloween song for you. This, every year, my friend Ron Penn, a music professor at the University of Kentucky, whose mother was born on Halloween, would send me a collection of Halloween tunes. That's what you've been hearing off this. Here is one of them, Halloween Spooks, Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross.
Halloween, Halloween, ooh, Halloween. Ghostly things are gonna happen. Ooh-ah, Halloween spooks outside my window. Halloween spooks behind the tree. I wish that the children could see, but I can't find them for the life of me. And there's Halloween spooks outside my window frame. My window, Halloween spooks
the tree. I wish that the children could see, but I can't find them for the life of me. And there's Halloween spooks outside my window.
What a great song, Halloween Spooks by Lambert Hendrix and Ross. It's part of this special CD that my old friend Ron Penn, retired music professor, professor emeritus at the University of Kentucky, makes for me, or made for me. He used to do it every year. And he has eight versions of the crazy song, Oh Death, on this thing. I will not play any of them for you. You're going to hear some wonderful singing and some wonderful jazz after the news from Joni Pilato, and Bradley Parker Sparrow will also talk about the astonishing 40th anniversary of their Southport Records and a Green Mill show that's happening next Sunday, so please stay tuned.
Away, oh, away, oh, away. Slowly moving fingers.
That is the voice of Joni Pilato. This is the voice of Joni Pilato. Hi, Joni Pilato.
Hi, Rick.
I don't know whether you sound better singing or talking. Joni Pilato and her incredibly talented husband, Bradley Parker Sparrow, have been friends of mine for a long time now. And you two continue to amaze me. Not just that you have kept Southport Records going for 40 years, but that you, Joni, continue to grow as one of the most extraordinary singers to ever sing in Chicago. Your latest CD is titled Float Out to Sea. This comes at the 40th anniversary of Southport Records. You got a big Green Mill show next Sunday. Does it sometimes, do you two ever... And hi, Sparrow, wherever you might be. I don't know if you're on.
I'm here.
Hey, of course you're here. Yeah, I didn't want to just keep complimenting your wife for the entire show, because you have a big part in this, too. Do you guys ever get the chance to sit? I know you work your tails off all the time, but to sit back and, you know, take the measure of what you've done for the last decades, do you ever get to do that?
Well, that's why we call the record Float Out to Sea. We're trying to relax.
But when you two, you know, when you two, you go back, you fall in love. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about when you first met. Either one of you, the one of you feeling most romantic at the moment, if you would go ahead.
Back in the old days, they would say, if you had a jazz band, you had to have a singer. And then I met Joni, and I had a singer.
Yeah.
Aww.
What do you think the first time you heard her, Sparrow?
I thought she looked good.
You didn't even hear her voice. You just said, oh, my God, this woman's beautiful. I hope she can sing. Hope she can sing.
You're right. I hope she can sing.
No, the first time he saw me, I was singing.
Where was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was at Redford's on Lincoln Avenue.
Wow.
We were doing a No Nukes benefit, and Sparrow was, as usual, doing everything. He was the sound man, and he was going to play with his band later. And I was singing with a guitar player, doing some standards, and he heard me sing. And then afterwards, he said he just lost his singer, or not lost, but she left the band. I guess, what was it, Sparrow? She had some fascination with...
Well, Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
Wow. So interesting. Yeah. You, Joni, are a native of Ohio, and you, Sparrow, are a child of the South Side. Did you both, Sparrow, you had, as I recall, if memory serves, and my memory is getting pretty shoddy, you had a ton of it. You taught yourself music, but then you also, am I wrong, you studied photography and journalism at DePaul and did a bunch of other things, didn't you?
Yeah, I was like... more wanted to be a photojournalist when I was younger.
Yeah, yeah.
And the piano was like a thing I did on the side, and it didn't make a lot of sense back then to that's when you had to like have the stop bath and the camera and the whole thing and the developing. And I went off in a more of a tangent for like just doing music.
Right. Well, you still, I mean, when we did, we all collaborated on a Cabrini Green kind of, you still bring to your, I think, to your songwriting and your music, a kind of, I hope you take this as praise, it's kind of, there's a sort of journalistic quality to it. Do you take that as praise or as, Rick, what are you, nuts? Which one?
No, I take it as more as just growing up in Chicago and,
yeah.
and seeing the way things are with the divisions in the city and stuff. And I see it more as just being more of a musician, more of a catalyst.
Well, you two are also, I mean, you're sort of catalysts and activists at the same time. I've always felt you have never shied away from making statements. Joni, when did you, Joni Pallotta, when did you come to music? How did you find music, and how did music find you? And at what point did you say, this is what I have to do my whole life?
Well, that's easy. When I was in junior high school, they always put me in the soprano section of the choir, and you can hear from my voice that I'm hardly a soprano. So I auditioned for a special ensemble, and I said, can I try out as an alto? And I found my voice. And from that moment on, really, I said, this is what, now I know, ninth grade, I think it was, now I know what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to be a singer, because I recognized that I knew I could sing then.
Right.
I heard my voice and I recognized it. And from that moment on, I, you know, studied music in college. And when I met Sparrow, of course, him being self-taught and me being schooled, it was very interesting, because I've always felt that I've learned really as much from Sparrow about music. You know, I think we both complement each other in different ways. And I had never sung original music, you know, until I met Sparrow. So it was very appealing to me, as was he.
Yeah, you guys are a great match. You guys are just a great match. When you two, and I still refine, a few years ago, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I remember, you know, I think you came out with, you know, the Southport Records came out with its like 137th CD, some number that just fascinated me. So I thought, well, it's about time we write about you. But when did you, take me back to when you guys decided, and, you know, because this is not, and you have lived through these last four decades, the 40th anniversary of Southport's going to be celebrated next Sunday. Next Sunday from 2 to 5 at the Green Mill, with a number of people who we'll talk about, and Willie Pickens and George Flynn, most of whom you have helped put on CD. What was the reason behind it? I, honest to God, you guys, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. Why, when and why did you start Southport Records? What was the catalyst for that?
Well, really, that goes back to Sparrow, because that goes pre-me.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, his first record was in 1977, a vinyl LP, his first record called Latin Black. And Sparrow, you can speak to this more than I, but basically that was the beginning of the label then called Sparrow Sound Design, which is our recording studio name. And Sparrow, you couldn't find a label, right?
You know, it's funny. Back in the old days, you figure you got something you're doing, you want to be like a band, like, you know, the Shadows of Night or something.
Yeah.
I mean,
right?
That's
yeah.
What I grew up with, and
sure.
You want to be like, and you want to have a label.
You want to be known.
Yeah. Because the label in those days, Sparrow, the label would do most of the heavy lifting and promotion and get you concerts and do all the, and, you know, make you money.
Right, and then you play all the gigs and stuff. And,
yeah.
And you'd go, but when I was younger, I tried to, my first record, to get it released, but nobody wanted to release it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it out of rejection, we started the label, kind of.
Well, it's an amazing, I mean, you guys have done.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Out of rejection.
Well, I know, but that, you know, I had a guy on last week, seriously, a lovely guy who had written a novel, and he couldn't, he's older, he's like 70, and he couldn't get anybody to even look at it. All 100 agents turned him down.
Right?
100 agents turned him down. He decided to self-publish the thing. He was discovered by a mainstream publisher, and he's now sold 500,000 books. So there you go. I'm going to spend another half hour with Bradley Parker Sparrow, who's a pianist and an entrepreneur and just a decent, wonderful, good guy, as is his wife. How long have you, Joni Pallotta, how long have you guys been married?
Well, we got married in 1982.
Well, I can't add, so ladies and gentlemen out there, as we take a commercial break, please figure out how long they've been married. And we're also going to play a couple cuts from, I love talking to you guys, but I also want people to hear this new CD, which, and they just keep getting better. It's called Float Out to Sea, because Sparrow and Joni need a vacation. That's the reason for the title. They want to float out to sea sometime, but they're too busy. We'll be right back. Head over to the Green Mill next Sunday from 2 to 5. It is a celebration not only of Joni Pallotta's new CD, Float Out to Sea, but the 40th anniversary of Southport Records. You guys had a big bash in New York last week, didn't you? What was that about?
Well, that was great. It was our return to a club called Pangea. It's in the East Village. We put on a really big show. We had a wonderful time. We got a nice online review in Nightlife Exchange. And we celebrated our 40th again. And
it is an amazing accomplishment. It's just an amazing accomplishment. Before I let, and I want you guys to call for it, I want people to hear a song from this new CD, which I think is every one of your CDs gets better. I mean, it's music and lyrics by the two. This is absolutely not the typical Kogan hyperbole. In this case, I actually mean it. This is not the Kogan BS, even though it's close to Halloween. This one is spectacular. How long was this in the making? I mean, when did the two of you, because you do collaborate so closely on this, say, do you say, well, it's time for another CD, or you say, God, Joni, I just wrote this song. I think we should record it. How does that happen? How does the CD happen?
We actually decided that it was time to make some new music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's really hard because I can't sing.
Right.
And I'm a piano player.
Well, I can't sing either. I can't sing either. So there are lots of us out there who can't sing. Don't worry about it.
So I get an idea for a song, and then Joni starts singing. She goes, "What are you doing there? What are you doing?"
That's
like, I can't sing that. Do you have an idea there? And then we go back and forth.
Oh God, it sounds wonderfully
collaborative. Well, you know, this record was one of the first times actually that Sparrow wrote two of the songs away from a piano entirely when we were out of town.
Wow.
We were in Florida for the first time ever in our lives, which I think is funny.
Yeah.
But last January, we went down to visit some friends, and we heard about the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, that they were ending their whole run.
Yeah.
And we read it in the New York Times, and Sparrow started writing some lyric ideas and for a song we included on the record.
Should we play it?
I think that'd be a great song to play, The Last
Wonderful.
Circus in Town.
What we're going to do is we'll play this, then we'll get some commercials, then we'll get some news, then we'll come back if you guys can stay awake, and we'll talk about the... I promise I
we
will stay awake.
Coffee, Rick.
I will stay awake. I promise you that. This is from... this then is the grand and ongoing and wonderful collaboration between Bradley Parker Sparrow and his wife, Joni Pallotta. This is from Joni's latest CD, Float Out to Sea. It is called, and it's cut four, Aubrey, it's called The Last Circus in Town. Enjoy.
No, 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 no. Can't you remember? As a child, your eyes would open wide as the magical posters would reveal a circus that just couldn't be real. The parade was led by a red-nosed clown as the ringmaster posed with his golden crown. The greatest show on earth, we bid a fond farewell. Nevermore to be. No more tigers or elephants or three magic rings to be found. No more bareback riders on three white horses or giant rats that spin around. No more sword-eating Egyptians or high wire axe that soar. The pink cotton candy in her sugared hair will make the tigers roar. The greatest show on earth, we bid a fond farewell, and you'll never see again the last circus in town. No more sideshows under the big top with fresh popcorn on the floor. Men were shot through cannons as the freaks waited behind the door. No more giant-breasted exotic women or sweaty muscle men in tights. For tonight, the mighty circus has turned out all the lights. The greatest show on earth, we bid a fond farewell, and you'll never see again the last circus. The last circus. The last circus. Goodbye.
Wow, that is a lovely, you two, that is an amazing song. I love, love that song. Now we got to get some commercials, which means that people are listening, which is a good thing. Then we'll get some news. Then we'll get some news, which means the world is still spinning. And then we'll come back and talk exclusively about the Green Mill Show next Sunday, and play another cut. That was just beautiful, you guys. Here's some commercials for you listening.
Good.
Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Bradley Parker Sparrow and his wife and business partner and creative. You are the muses of one another. You know that, don't you? And I found something during the commercials, you guys said some time to me ago that I really love. You have run Southport Records. Sparrow's run it for 40 years now, and Joni came in about a few years after he started, and they've done some remarkable things, keeping alive the music of such people as Catherine Davis and King Fleming and Josie Falbo and Linda Tate. They're up to, like, now about 150 releases. But you guys told me something. Sperry, you told me a long time ago, and these quotes have stayed in my mind. You said, my theory is instead of selling a million records, I'll make a million individual records that,
yeah,
are true, that are true to my visions. I love that. And, Joni, you in the same story I wrote said, when you're a jazz artist putting out jazz records, you're not going to be a big star anyway, so you just do what you love. That's when the truth shines. Those are just that's a remarkable philosophy that you two share in that. And I know when you make a CD, it is kind of a labor of love, but you also like to perform live. Tell me about the show. It's next Sunday from 2 to 5 at the Green Mill.
This coming Sunday, yeah. November 5th from 2 to 5, and we're going to have a great time at the Green Mill. I also wanted to say that, you know, any recording project or our label is a labor of love, but yeah, it's also a group of musicians together. And on this record that we just released, our musicians are really part of the stew. They made it happen. We're a team. John Devlin, our bass player, is so amazing. He plays bass, guitar, and vocals on the record. Louise Everling is a drummer that just gets Sparrow. They really hook up, and it makes it happen. Willie Pickens is going to be there.
Oh, wow.
With us. He's one of our early artists on the label with It's About Time. We released so long ago,
sure,
his first CD, his first LP at,
yeah,
the time. Our Southport Composers Series classical artist George Flynn will be there. Willie and George do these crazy improvised duets together, which is really pretty amazing to see them perform together. Jazz vocalist Martha Lauren, she was with us in New York. She's,
yep,
going to be flying in to perform. And our group, Todd Carter's group TV Pal, is also going to be there doing their electronic stuff. So we've got a big mix of music.
It's always a collaborative thing with you.
It is collaborative.
I mean, the fact that, you know, the fact that the genius Bobby Lewis is playing on one of the tracks on
absolutely,
the CD,
he's
is
on the
a
first cut.
Mm-hmm. I know.
We always call him the king.
Yeah,
yeah, I do too. And you know, one of the other things, he's like you too. I mean, you can think of like the jazz world of being like a bunch of like crazy people. It is the nicest gathering of human beings.
Well, Bobby's like us in that he has to keep recording and putting records out. It's,
yeah,
just like something you have to do.
I know. Let me, the show, you can go, ladies and gentlemen, to chicagosound.com. to find out everything you may need to know that you didn't learn on this show about Bradley Parker Sparrow and Joni Pilato, and order all of their CDs.
Including, I have to say,
yes,
that we've collaborated with you, Mr. Kogan.
That's right.
On We Are Not Machines.
Yep.
Rick read Sparrow's poem, Little John, on that CD.
Oh,
uh-huh.
I read because I can't sing. But I'm still flattered to be asked, because I also greatly admire Sparrow's writing. I mean, it's socially conscious. I mean, it's... And that last Circus in Town song is a winner and a half, you guys.
Well,
I'm going to let you leave and go to sleep by picking. You guys can go to sleep, not I.
I guess you kind of know us then,
yes,
huh?
Yes, exactly. I don't know you.
How are we musicians,
yeah,
that are early birds? I don't know. It's,
yeah,
all
you're right.
Fault,
name one tune you'd like off the new CD you'd like people to hear right now, and then you can
Sparrow,
go hug each
what
other.
What do you want?
It's your call, kids.
Ooh, they're all so good.
I know. You want to do the title track? You want to do Float
Out? Yeah, let's do Float Out to,
okay,
Sea. That's great.
You two, knock them dead next Sunday, and keep in touch. You're two of my favorite people and two of the great, great artists in this town.
Thank you so much,
Rick. You're not actually, the first song I was dedicating to King Crimson.
Oh, how nice. How nice. Well, of course. Here from Joni Pilato's latest CD, Float Out to Sea, is the title track, track to float out to sea. Thank you guys so much.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome back. In the next issue of Chicago Magazine, there will be a piece by my friend and a guy I admire tremendously, Mike Thomas. So I made him stay up this late. Maybe he's actually watching that Cold World series or something. Mike, thanks a million. The piece, the version I've seen, which is like the version that will be in the magazine when it's published momentarily, is fascinating. Medusa's was a... the most famous all, as you say, the most famous all ages club, obviously in the history of Chicago. It only lasted for 9 years on Sheffield. It closed 25 years ago, which makes me feel so old, Mike. How did you come upon this story? Were you a Medusa's guy?
No, I wasn't. I didn't even move to Chicago until 95.
Yeah, that's what I
so
thought.
This was something the editors presented to me. I had done oral histories for them in the past, and we thought this could be something fun. You know, and I like the entertainment stuff, as you know.
Sure.
I was a Dr. Nightlife like you. But,
that's right. Well, yes. You wound up in a mental institution, Dr. Nightlife. But you have.
Yeah,
I mean, you covered the arts and entertainment scene for the Sun-Times for almost 15 years. You've written two fantastic books, The Second City Unscripted, Revolution and Revelation, at the world-famous Comedy Theater that was published in 2009, and your book about, which I love them both, but this one, you might remember me, The Life and Times of Phil Hartman, is a seminal kind of biography that was published
in
2014. What did you think? You know, I must tell you, I never spent a lot of time at Medusa. It just wasn't kind of my scene. I think I had outgrown the doctor. Dr. Nightlife went away and was put in a mental institution. I had to move on to other stuff. What you must have really gotten into it, because the place is fascinating.
I did get into it. I really did. It was fascinating for a lot of reasons. I mean, one, because it was this sort of bastion of this provocative performance art. It was also on the cutting edge as far as music went, you know, punk, industrial. And the clientele was so eclectic, and they all got along under one roof, punks, jocks, goths. People who were gay, people who were straight, everybody. It was just a huge melting pot. And for some reason, once they got inside, most of those tensions, if there weren't any on the outside, melted away.
Yeah, one of the things that really impressed me about it, and you talked to, you know, the interesting thing is, and you're a great reporter, but how did you figure out that Bridget Murphy, one of Chicago's legendary performance artists, and Ursula Bielski, who is now busier than busy because she is the leading ghost tour person in town. How did you find out that those two, and they're wonderful in the piece, they're former patrons. They weren't performers. They were just kids going there, right?
They were, yeah. I'm trying to say Bridget did a little bit of performing there, but Ursula just went there as a high schooler. I must have come across their names in articles. I don't know, maybe one that you wrote years ago,
because I
know you've known Bridget for years. But,
sure.
But you know, you go through stacks and stacks of stuff, and you just read and read and read, and you pluck names out. And that's part of how you get the names to pursue. And then, of course, also people say, oh, you should talk to him, you should talk to her. And it just kind of snowballs. And so I've gotten the hang of this oral history stuff more and more.
I got you on for about 10 minutes, and I want to talk to you a little about the oral history, the way of doing oral history. I think one of the first ones I remember was it George Plimpton, the book Edie, about Edie Sedgwick? Remember that book?
Yeah, sure.
That may have been
the
first one of these that pieced together a biography from different voices. And when you're a good reporter, as is Mike Thomas, you can do that. You also can take from other sources. You have a cop in your piece quoted from a Tribune article of the time calling, which really was unfair, I think, calling the patrons of Medusa's on Sheffield spoiled rich kids from the suburbs. That was not the case at all, was it?
No, it was not. They came from everywhere. I mean, of course, there were some of everything, but he was totally generalizing. Yeah, once in a while, you'll come across this great quote that just pops from a publication, and I'll put it in there if it's really germane to the piece, but I really like using original sources. And, you know, I mean, I probably used, I would say, 10% of what I collected reporting-wise. You get just reams of material, and you wish you could use it all, but we only have so much space.
Well, I love the whole notion, and you have also, I mean, just pick the right people. You've got Joe Shanahan, who...
Up and met with Joe for a while. He's great.
Yeah, and had you met him before?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you must have known Joe.
For years, sure.
Yeah, Joe is very, very good on this thing. But also, the interesting thing about it was, as are many things that fly in the face of convention, assailed by the powers that be. I found that to be a fascinating part of this tale, too. Bernie Hansen, et cetera.
Yeah, he was interesting to talk to. I tracked him down. I don't know where he was. I can't even remember now. But we talked for a little bit, and he remembered it vaguely and had some thoughts about it. He just knew he tried to shut it down, and for some reason he couldn't. It was in this gentrifying neighborhood on Sheffield and Lakeview, and you know, the patrons who would go there, they would trickle out, and they would be loud going to their cars, and when it was an all-night place, I mean, that could go on till 6, 7, 8 in the morning. I mean, later on, they would shut down earlier at 2 or 3, and so the neighbors were placated a little more. But, you know, the neighbors would carp, and then they'd tell Bernie, and Bernie would lead these raids into the club, and they would shut them down temporarily. So there was a game they played for years.
Yeah, and you capture it so well. The interesting guy, too, one of the really interesting guys is this guy, Dave Shelton, who started it, as you detail, borrowing some dough from his mom. What compelled this guy?
You know, he had been at a lot of these clubs himself, dancing and sort of getting a feel for, you know, how they operated. And he tried a couple of clubs of his own that never really took off. And he just decided that this was going to be his game. He had worked for United Airlines. He was a teacher for a while. But he just decided that this was kind of his calling, and he borrowed, I think, 16 grand from his mom, and he ended up selling some of his possessions. And, you know, back then you could get, you know, rents weren't all that much up where he was. It was 1983. And so he was able to get this space that had been sort of a Swedish social club of some sort years before. And he just started this club, and it grew by word of mouth. They barely did any advertising.
Yeah. And then he wound up, as you again detail in this fine piece, Mike Thomas, that will appear momentarily, I think, in Chicago Magazine.
It's actually on the stands now. You can get it
on
the stands now. Yeah,
good.
It'll be online as of tomorrow.
Yeah, it fascinated me, and I knew just a bit about Medusas. But what you seem to have captured is, you know, someone else in your story, in this kind of oral history of the place, calls it a poor man's Studio 54. You captured, this is going to resonate, I think, with thousands of not so young people anymore, but people who were young then.
I hope so.
There's no question about it. And this guy, this Dave Shelton, went on to found or open a Medusa's in Elgin is it still open?
It's still open to this day. Of course, it's not as fabled as the original one. But, you know, Dave was always kind of a motherly figure, to a fatherly figure, however you want to put it. He was very nurturing. Because a lot of these kids, and they were kids who came in, especially when they started having more teen dance nights, they had a lot of issues they were dealing with. And he would make sure they were okay. And the people he worked with were the same way. They were just a very nurturing family-like atmosphere, as they recalled it for me.
Wow. Are you sorry you never went there? I mean, when you do these
kind
of pieces, Mike, because, you know, people's memories can be, and when you pile on a lot of memories, can get very vivid and very of the moment. Did you feel that?
I did, and I'm always happy when people have great emotional memories for this stuff. Because, I mean, that happened with Second City, too. They were really attached to the place, and you start talking to them about it 5 minutes later, they're right back there in it. And that's what you really need as an oral historian, is for them to take you back emotionally, not only what happened, but how they felt when it happened. And that happened with the Medusa's piece as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're doing these kind of things. I know that you're doing other things, too, but I think also what you'll find after this piece is published, it's on the newsstands right now, it'll be online sometime this week, it's Mike Thomas on Medusa's, a sort of oral history, 25 years after the club closed on Sheffield. I have to believe, and I couldn't chart it now, but that this place had a huge, huge, if subtle, impact on the whole nightlife scene as it has been in the last 25 years, don't you think?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of people have said that musically, aesthetic wise, you know, with all the performance installations, there was Dave wanted eye candy everywhere, and so if you weren't downstairs dancing, you were looking at video projections, or you were looking at some bizarre live performance art happening behind glass. He wanted something in every corner of the place.
Well, you really bring it home in this, Mike. Come on the show one day.
Thanks, Rick.
Come in,
I'd love to.
You know, and we'll just sit here and shoot the breeze about life and times. Mike Thomas is one of my favorite writers. He has spent much of his career covering the arts and entertainment scene, some for the Sun-Times and now for national magazines and Chicago Magazine and in books, and read him in this current issue, just on the stands now, about Medusas. You will be taken back in time, because that's what a good oral history does. Mike, take care of yourself. It's always good to talk to you. Take care.
You too. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime. Anytime. Take care. Happy Halloween. Because that's my favorite holiday. Aubrey Mumpower, happy Halloween. Lise Graham, happy Halloween. You won't be here next week. We'll only be on for an hour next week, but I will have Jonathan Eich, the author of the new biography of Muhammad Ali, on here. Carl Amari is coming up, and this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on iTunes. It is 11 o'clock on the dot, and Roger, this World Series game is out of control.
Isn't it, though?
Out of control.
Just amazing.
Yes, devote the whole news to it. Happy Halloween, okay. My friend.
You
See
too.
You next week.